We've been waiting for you. Come on in. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and Dr. Erica Reamer for March 19th, 2024. Today, we welcome Senior Healthcare Consultant Angela Comfort to report on the future of ICD-10 and ICD-11. We'll get the latest coding news from Lori Johnson. Tiffany Ferguson covers the social determinants of health. Tim Powell is at the Tuesday News Desk, and Dr. Reamer presents her talkback segment. Now here's the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, the host of Talk 10 Tuesday, and a man whose idea of March Madness is playing a bunch of John Philip Sousa records, Chuck Buck.
Yeah, in step right. Hey, thanks, Mike Anthony. Hello, everybody, and walk through the 590th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, listeners.
And as you heard Clark Anthony announce, Angela Cuthbert has returned. She's going to be with us today. She's going to report on the future of ICD-10 and also ICD-11. So, Erica, what's your reaction to all of that?
Well, I'm sure that the state of ICD-11 is going to be of great interest to our listeners.
Yeah, indeed it is. So, Erica, what's your topic for your talkback today?
I'm going to be talking about clinical validation, and then I'm off to Columbus to talk at OHEMA 2024.
Wow, very good. Well, Erica, we look forward to your talkback segment this morning, as we always do. We've got a lot of news to report, so we begin this morning with Tim Powell. Tim is at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
Thanks, Chuck. And today I'm going to talk about why we should care about the Chevron doctrine. The removal of the Chevron doctrine by the Supreme Court seems more and more likely based on comments from their court and supporters. It would present a seismic shift in the administrative law and the relationship between the judicial, executive, and legislative branches of the United States government, established by the Supreme Court's 1984 decision in Chevron USA versus Natural Resources Defense Council, Inc. The doctrine articulates a principle of deference to administrative agencies' interpretation of statutes that they are tasked with enforcing. Under the Chevron framework, courts must defer to an agency's interpretation of an ambiguous statute if the interpretation is deemed reasonable. In terms of legal and regulatory implications, without the Chevron deference, courts would no longer be bound to lean on agencies' expertise in ambiguous statutory situations. This could result in more active or interventionist judicial role in administrative matters, with judges relying more on their own interpretations of statutes rather than on the agency's expertise. This shift could have both positive and negative legal consequences. On one hand, it might lead to increased judicial oversight of regulatory agencies, potentially resulting in more consistent, transparent application of the law. I think, on the other hand, the demise of Chevron will lead to regulatory uncertainty and inconsistency. Agencies, including CMS, have long relied on the doctrine to flexibly interpret and apply statutes in complex, rapidly evolving areas such as healthcare. Without the deference, CMS would become more conservative in their rulemaking and read this as longer and more detailed proposed and final rules, potentially slowing innovation and adaptation of regulatory approaches. In terms of policy and political applications, the removal of the Chevron deference would significantly impact policymaking process and the political landscape. CMS would face increasing challenges in implementing policies, including policies that are already in place. This would necessitate more detailed and specific legislation from Congress, shifting some of the policymaking burden back to the legislative branch. However, given the often gridlock nature of Congress, this could result in legislative inertia, making it difficult to respond promptly to new challenges and changes that are needed. Politically, at the end of Chevron could alter the dynamics of presidential administrations and their ability to effectuate policy changes through regulatory action. Presidents might find it more challenging to fulfill campaign promises that rely on agencies' interpretations and enforcement of statutes. This could lead to increasing pressure on Congress to pass legislation, potentially exacerbating partisan divides and making it more difficult to enact laws. In terms of economic and social implications, providers and insurance plans paid by Medicare and Medicaid would face greater uncertainty and compliance costs without the Chevron deference. The possibility of more frequent and unpredictable shifts in regulatory interpretation with changes in administration could make long-term planning much more difficult. So in summary, the removal of the Chevron doctrine could fundamentally alter the balance of power among the branches of the U.S. government, affect efficiency and predictability of the regulatory process and have wide-ranging implications for legal policy and economic and social landscapes. The exact nature and extent of these impacts would depend on how deeply the judiciary wants to get involved in the legislative business and the executive branches of businesses. So with that being said, back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Tim, very much. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert, and he's also the national correspondent for ICD-10 Monitor. It's Tuesday. It's March 19th. It's officially the first day of the vernal equinox. And it's also the first day of the Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting taking place right now at CMS headquarters. And, of course, you're listening to the 590th live edition of Talked In Tuesday. Stand by.
Maximize your reimbursement potential with expert-guided insights into 2024 interventional radiology coding changes. The best approach is to begin your journey with the Interventional Radiology Coding Starter Kit. This package, featuring the ebook, coding e-charts, and exclusive webinar, is designed to provide expert-guided insights for new and seasoned coders. With payment cuts in the 2024 PFS final rule, every reimbursement dollar is at stake. So ensure accurate coding and maximize reimbursement as you secure your success in 2024 with this invaluable starter package, the Interventional Radiology Coding Starter Kit.
Now's the time for the Talked In Tuesday Coding Report with Lori Johnson. And Lori is standing by to report on day one of the Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting. It's taking place right now at CMS headquarters in Baltimore. And good morning, Lori. What's happening?
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, Erica. And hello to our listeners. As you said, today kicks off the Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting, which is being held virtually. You must register to attend and make comments on proposals. There are options to listen only as well. And Daniel can post that information in the chat. The meeting began actually 9 o'clock. AM sharp Eastern time with the procedure agenda, which has 26 items on the agenda, including the addenda and the Section X updates. The meeting will take a lunch break at 12:30 p.m. Eastern time and reconvene at 1:30. Proposals will be presented until 5 o'clock p.m. And the projection is that the procedure agenda will take the entire day today. The diagnosis part of the meeting will follow the procedure agenda, so it looks like it will start at 9 a.m. sharp tomorrow morning. And again, that tomorrow's meeting can go up until 5 o'clock p.m. There are 9 proposals in the procedure packet that will not be presented, but are under consideration. CMS is encouraging your comments on these topics. All of these proposals have requested a new technology add-on payment status for fiscal year 25 or fiscal year 26. Comments on the October 2024 implementation are due on April 19th, and public comments are due by May 17th for those topics that are scheduled for implementation April 2025. The next Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting is scheduled for September 10th and 11th. I was watching prior to jumping on here, and the following items have been presented so far. Restriction using thoracoabdominal branch endoprosthesis, which is used to treat aortic aneurysms. It has that proposal requested NTAP status for fiscal year 25. Tibiotalocanial fusion with a fixation implant, which provides stabilization of the hind foot and the ankle. It has also requested NTAP for fiscal year 25. There was some discussion on this proposal regarding to how surgeons may refer to it as. They may refer to it as a spacer or a cage. And again, this is an implant for a fusion. So there was some concerns that the coder could get lost with the type of terminology that was being used. The third item that was just started when I left was endovascular aortic repair, referred to as EVAR. It's using fiber optic 3D guidance, and it has requested an NTAP for fiscal year 26. It's quite a busy agenda for today and tomorrow, and the presenters are moving quickly. So with that, Erica, back to you.
Thanks, Lori. It always amazes me how good coders are at basically code what I'm doing, not what I say. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is Senior Healthcare Consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica, and thank you again, Lori Johnson. And we're going to circle back with Lori Johnson at the end of this broadcast with an update on the Coordination Maintenance Committee meeting that's taking place right now at CMS headquarters in Baltimore.
Coding for wound care management and debridement could be a challenge for most coders. There are many challenges that can lead to inaccuracies and hinder proper reimbursement. Unfortunately, incomplete or insufficient documentation and evolving coding guidelines further complicate the coding process, making it essential to address these concerns promptly. Now you can master wound care coding during an upcoming webcast with Senior Healthcare Consultant Gina Iacovelli. She will provide targeted education, practical examples, and updates to address the unique difficulties faced in coding wound care management and debridement. Gina will help you bridge knowledge gaps, enhance your coding skills, and equip you with the resources needed to navigate the evolving landscape of this specialized field. The webcast is tomorrow, Wednesday, March 20th at 1:30 p.m. Eastern.
Here now with the Talk 10 Tuesday report on the social determinants of health is Tiffany Ferguson. Good morning, Tiffany.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, all. I'd like to talk about today the last week's release from the Biden-Harris on health initiatives for their proposed budget for 2025. The details of this is released in their Health Resources Services Administration, so the HRSA briefing, and really outlines six top initiatives. From even this reporting where I put together, it looks like every week they're releasing full details on these specific initiatives. So the first is youth mental health crisis. So disturbing trends in youth mental health that have been known is that nearly one third of youth reporting experiences with poor mental health, and one in five students are reporting seriously considering suicide. So the budget is really focusing on expanding access to mental health and substance use disorder treatment, particularly for youth. Investments include training 12,000 new behavioral health care providers, creating a peer-to-peer mental health support program for youth, supporting mental health training for pediatricians, and integrating mental health services into community health centers. Next is maternity care deserts. I think you guys have heard me talk a lot about that. So there is additional funding that's coming out for that, specifically in increasing and building obstetric capacity in underserved areas, training more labor and delivery nurses and certified nurse midwives, establishing a community-based doula workforce, and expanding access to maternal mental health support through the National Maternal Health Hotline at 1-833-TLC-MAMA. Initiative three is closing gaps in access to primary care. So recognizing the barriers we know in accessing primary care, such as lack of providers, lack of access to transportation, and limited availability in appointment times and provider hours, this is only, we know, exacerbated in rural and underserved areas. The budget aims to double the federal investment in community health centers, expand health center street medicine services for the homeless, and expand health center operating hours. How they're going to do that, more information is coming out. Next initiative is meeting opiate treatment and recovery needs. And again, a particular specific reach to address this is for rural communities who have limited access for opioid use disorder treatment. The budget focuses on creating more access for this community by supporting more mobile clinics, mobile units for medication-assisted treatment, integrating supportive services, and expanding the rural substance use disorder workforce. In general, they're looking to grow the healthcare workforce. They're hoping to do this by providing scholarships and loan repayment programs to over an estimate of 24,000 clinicians, nurses, and healthcare professionals to provide services in underserved areas. They're also going to be supporting about 1,800 medical and dental residents to work and train in rural communities and fund new approaches to recruit and diversify the healthcare workforce. So this is additional support. Last was transforming the organ matching system, which I thought was interesting. There wasn't a lot of details in the report initially, but it looks like more is coming out. What they had highlighted was the enhancing the organ procurement process and transplantation system. The budget hopes to double the funding for this system and aims to increase competition and support updates to improve performance and innovation related to organ matching. So overall, these investments are attempting to align with the administration's goals of improving health care access, addressing mental health challenges, and ensuring equitable care for all Americans, really focusing on diverse and rural communities. And with that, back to you, Erica.
Hey, Tiffany, don't go anywhere for a second because I have a question for you. I love that 1-800-TLC-MAMA. But when I was, my kids were little, they called me Mama, but we spelled it M-O-M-M-A. I'm assuming it's M-A-M-A. Would that be correct?
It is. Yes. So it's 1-833 TLC-MAMA. Yes.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, right. Tiffany. That was Tiffany Ferguson. Tiffany is CEO for Phoenix Medical Management.
Senior healthcare consultant Angela Comfort joins us this morning as she leads us into the future. And good morning, Angie. Welcome back. So what does the future for ICD-10 and health informatics hold for us?
Well, good morning, Chuck and everyone. Thanks for having me back on Talk 10 Tuesday. So today we're going to venture into the future, a future where the worlds of ICD-10 coding and health informatics converge and transform in ways we are only beginning to imagine. So let's dive into that evolving landscape of medical coding and how it impacts healthcare professionals, patients, and the broader health IT ecosystem. First up, let's talk about the big white elephant in the coding room, the potential transition from ICD-10 to ICD-11. The World Health Organization released ICD-11 for implementation over 3 years ago, making a significant leap in medical classification. Unlike its predecessor, ICD-11 is designed to integrate seamlessly with health IT systems, offering more detailed information, which facilitates better global healthcare and surveillance and more precise patient care. The question isn't if we will transition, rather when and how. This transition will be monumental, requiring extensive training, system updates, and a period of adjustment for all stakeholders. And I foresee it to be a lot longer period of adjustment than we had for ICD-10. But the promise is there of more accurate data, improved global health tracking, and enhanced patient care. So as we look ahead, the role of medical coding in big data and analytics cannot be overstated. Medical codes are the cornerstone in the vast machinery of health data, enabling us to turn individual health records into actionable insights. With advances in AI and machine learning, the potential to use this data to predict epidemics, improve quality of life, and tailor medical treatments to individual patients is within our grasp. Coders will need to be at the forefront of this shift, ensuring their data accuracy and integrity, while also embracing their expanding role as data analysts, along with their coding abilities. The future of ICD-10 and health informatics will also be shaped by the evolving health IT infrastructure. Interoperability and data sharing are becoming the norm, driven by policies like the 21st Century Cures Act in the US. And this means that coding systems need to be more adaptable and integrated than ever before. As electronic health records become more sophisticated and widespread, the demand for coders who can navigate these systems to ensure that data flows seamlessly across borders and between providers will definitely skyrocket. So what does this all mean for the coding profession? It means growth, evolution, and opportunity. Coders will need to adapt to new technologies, learn new coding systems like ICD-11, and embrace that their roles already have or will be expanding to include data analysts and informatics specialists. The future will demand a blend of technical skills, clinical knowledge, and data analytics expertise. However, with these challenges come opportunities to be at the forefront of healthcare innovation. This contributes directly to improved patient outcomes and the global health landscape. As we look to the horizon, the future of ICD-10 coding and health informatics is bright and bustling with potential. The transition to ICD-11, the integration of coding with big data and analytics, and the evolution of health IT infrastructure present both challenges and opportunities for professionals in this field. By truly embracing the change and continuing to learn, our coding professionals can ensure they remain vital to the healthcare system's future, driving forward improvements in patient care and global health. Until next time, keep coding and keep innovating. Let's go back over to Erica.
Angie, thank you. You made that sound so exciting. That was Angie Comfort, Assistant Vice President of Revenue Integrity and Revenue Cycle at Montefiore.
Now here is Dr. Erica Reamer with her very popular segment here at Talk to Tuesday. It's called Talk Back, and it features our own Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer, it is all yours.
Thanks, Chuck. I've been involved in a lively discussion on LinkedIn about clinical validation audits. The 2011 Recovery Audit Program Statement of Work used to read, quote, clinical validation is a separate process which involves a clinical review of the case to see whether or not the patient truly possesses the conditions that were documented. Clinical validation is beyond the scope of DRG, parenthesis coding, close parenthesis validation, and the skills of a certified coder. This type of review can only be performed by a clinician or may be performed by a clinician with approved coding credentials, close quote. The PA, who had been frustrated from clinical validation audits, went on to say, quote, only a bedside clinician is able to understand, interpret, judge a patient's clinical condition, close quote. And he pondered how, quote, a medical director can have clinical acumen sitting in an office who has relinquished bedside medical practice for the comfort of an office, awaiting a bonus to churn out denials, close quote. It is exasperating to waste time, energy, and money on fighting denials when the condition is unmistakably present. On the other hand, the payer shouldn't have to pay for services which are not valid, like in the case of an erroneous DRG or TIER. The statement of work only disallowed coders from doing clinical validation for CMS. It never prohibited non-clinicians from being able to do reviews for institutions or commercial payers for that matter. Some of the best CDISs I ever worked with came from the HIM world, and I'm going to see them very shortly at OHIMA. And they were more than equipped to do clinical validation. One needs to have experience in the clinical sector and intimate knowledge of the medical record. If you can perform as a CDIS, you can do clinical validation. Actually, the only one who really can do clinical validation is a practitioner responsible for the patient's medical care. Was there really sepsis or acute hypoxic respiratory failure? If they were there ordering the sepsis protocol or intubating the patient, they really know. The rest of us can only read their documentation and infer clinical validity. In fact, and this was eye-opening to me because I did not realize this, in 2017, CMS removed that apocryphal paragraph, and the statement of work now reads, clinical validation is prohibited in all RAC reviews. But Dr. Ron Hirsch and I objected to the insinuation that if you are not a practicing clinician, you are not competent to perform clinical validation. I don't practice now, but I was an emergency physician for 25 years. I haven't forgotten how medicine works. And I would say I am an expert at assessing documentation, which is, after all, how we judge clinical validity, even if I don't still work shifts in the ED. I don't think Siraj really thinks medical directors are unable to determine clinical validity if they no longer practice medicine. I think his concern is that some of them have an unholy alliance to protect the payer's bottom line, as opposed to ensuring that excellent medical care is delivered to their beneficiaries and appropriately reimbursed. Having an artificial intelligence review records and issue denials by the hundreds in seconds working on contingency where denials are generated regardless of the details of the encounter, rejecting appeals without weighing the merits, and collecting bonuses merely for productivity are all just plain wrong. Having worked on both sides, I can see both sides. The system was designed with checks and balances. Providers shouldn't get paid for services they didn't render. Payers shouldn't be able to get out of paying for legitimate services that were provided. If providers deliver excellent medical care and document their thought process well, then payers should pay for medically necessary care of their beneficiaries. If any of these elements is not present, there should be consequences. Clinical validation is one cog in that process, and you don't have to have an actively practicing practitioner to make that judgment. Next week, I will catch Ron Hirsch's ball and run with sepsis. Until then, back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Erica, very much. And now we're going to circle back to Lori Johnson for some closing thoughts on today's Coordination Maintenance Committee meeting. Lori.
I did take a quick peek in at the Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting. They're talking about lymphatic bypass, which is used to treat lymphedema or to prevent it. The next topic up for discussion is performance of extracorporeal circulatory filtration. They seem to be running right on time. And with that, back to you.
All right, thanks. That is going to be a wrap for this. Our 590th live edition of Talk to Tuesday. I want to thank our panel today, Tiffany Ferguson, Lori Johnson, reporter from CMS, Tim Powell, Angela Comfort, a reporter on Early Story, and of course, a very special thank you to my good friend, Dr. Erica Reamer, and reporting for Talk to Tuesday and ICD-10 Monitor. I'm Chuck Buck. Have a great week, everybody.
Talk 10 Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.